Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Bradfold, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the 17th day of April, 2024. We're ready for oral arguments. It's important that the attorneys state their names for the record before each leg of the argument, so we have you identified for the recording that is made and available to the public. The first case is Olson v. Johnson. Counsel for appellant should approach and begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Sawiski on behalf of the appellant, Tara Olson, Tara Johnson now. So we're here today, just briefly in background, after a stipulated judgment decree reserving three issues for the district court. One was the issue of life insurance securing maintenance. There was an issue as to arrears, which is not on appeal today, and as to attorney fees was the third issue. The court entered the stipulated judgment decree, which set the incomes and needs of the parties on spousal maintenance, and that was, again, stipulated, so all agreed. That was in November, I believe, of 2022, November 14th. It then issued its order on December 23 on the remaining issues of 2022. We felt that there were errors in that order and so brought a motion for amended findings, and the court then issued its orders, one changing portions of its 1223 order and the other providing rationale in the form of a memorandum, basically. That was the second order. Those were issued on April 25th, 2023, I believe. The problem with the court's decision in both of its orders, both in December and April, are that it doesn't actually tell us why it's not exercising its discretion to award security for the spousal maintenance.
So, well, counsel, there are some findings. When you say that the district court doesn't explain why, I mean, there definitely are findings that are relevant to the issue.
Well, the findings as to the issue of security would be the Mader findings. And the court acknowledges the age, the experience, the work history, the employment history, all of those things, the education, are what Mader urges courts to look at when making these decisions. These are all, and again, these are all the same.
Those findings are in the district court.
They are, and they're all stipulated findings.
We're going to review this for abuse of discretion, right?
Correct.
So help me out there. Where's the abuse of discretion? We got the findings, we got the law, district court applied the law.
Because the findings along those lines do not support the court's decision not to exercise its discretion. What those findings suggest is a woman who was 48 years old after a 23-year marriage, so a long-term marriage, who had not been out of the homestead but for 4 years of the marriage, working full-time or part-time, as it was.
So, counsel, when I hear you say that, I did read your briefs really carefully, so I don't mean to rush you through this. If you want to go back, I just want to tell you the parts that I'm struggling with. All right. So you tell me the findings do not support the district court's conclusion not to require security for the permanent spousal maintenance. It seems to me that, in part, what you're asking us to do is reach a different conclusion from these facts. And that is, of course, exactly what we don't do with an abuse of discretion standard of review. So it seems like it's got to be more than that the findings don't support the judge's conclusion, or else I'm missing something.
Well, so I would say this. That I think, though, that would be the case if the findings, so an abuse of discretion standard, the way I understand it, would be facts applied to the logic, right, or the facts in the case, and the court using its logic to apply to the standards required, right? Okay. So if we're looking at those issues, you would look at, you know, whether the idea of the age, her work experience, the length of the marriage, what she actually earns, all when looked at in the context of the marriage and applied, would require a security in the form of life insurance on a permanent spousal maintenance award. Now, the permanent part is a stipulated determination by the parties.
Right, so you seem to be getting something that at least I wasn't finding in the case law. You're saying that these factors should be looked at to determine whether security is required for permanent spousal maintenance. And what is it about the factors, at least as expressed in our case law, that would lead the court to weigh in favor of security as opposed to going the other way? Because we have no doubt the judge looked at the evidence and looked at the factors.
Well,
we got that.
Yeah, I'll set that last little comment aside for a second. I'll come right back to
okay.
it. But I think the issue here is once you look at those factors, and again, they are the same factors in deciding permanency under the statute. Once you look at those factors, I think your step is then you say, okay, it is appropriate to have a security here. And then you go to the next step. And I don't say it's a two-part step, but I think then you look at the insurability and cost of insurance issues.
And we don't have that in the case law.
I understand. Right? Well, there is discussion of that, and I can come back to that
okay.
and provide that to you on
all right.
my rebuttal. But and the court certainly references it in its order.
Definitely.
I
see that.
I think the problem is if you're ignoring the factors, and I think to go back to your comment then at the end there, I think what the court actually did here is said, look, we're going to run, I don't want to say run roughshod, we're going to ignore what the parties stipulated to, which was 35 hours a week at $20 an hour for my client.
So, excuse me, are you saying the district court ignored the stipulated facts?
He did.
Okay.
He absolutely did.
All right, so counsel, explain that to me.
So if you go look at the findings in both orders that the court finds, or the court lays out.
I see a lot of repetition between the orders, actually.
He did, and that's
yeah.
why I'm saying.
Right.
Both. There's two findings in there that both suggest that my client is underemployed. And we pointed that out on our motion for amended findings, that was inappropriate, that the parties had stipulated to these facts. 35 hours a week, that was her work, her weekly work hours at $20 an hour. Now, those can go up. We understand that. Theoretically, in the future, you could go to 40 hours. Maybe you make more. But those are the bases for modification, not for the basis of a decision of whether a permanent spousal maintenance award stipulated to by the parties. That's the evidence in front of the court when it makes its decision. There was no motion here for modification. This was a reserved issue based on the facts that the parties had stipulated to.
So would you go back, please, to where the district
sure.
court ignored facts that were included in
so,
what the J and D.
Yes.
So which of the facts
I think it's findings 9, 10, and 11 in the courts, in both orders.
When you say 9, 10, I mean, I've read your briefs, right?
Yeah.
So when you say 9, 10, 11, you're actually not referring to the J and D. You're referring to the district court's order on this issue, on
yes.
the insurance.
No, the J and D specifically said 35 hours was the ability of the appellant to work. That was the hourly amount per week.
So you're saying when the district court finds that there's no evidence that the appellant in this case can't work full-time, you're saying full-time is different from 35 hours a week?
It is. It's 40 hours a week.
So counsel, I mean, I just don't see that in the record. And I know there are you relying on something? I mean, is there something in family law that tells me that it's always 40 hours? Because as you know, employers often define full-time in different ways.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
That could possibly be what the court was thinking, but the court doesn't say that.
Right.
What the court says is we believe that she can work more hours, that she is not limited as to her hours.
That's the part I don't see, that the district court changes the definition of full-time. The judge just says full-time, maybe the judgment 35 hours a week. I mean, that was the finding in the J&D.
So. It could, but then what we know from the judgment decree is based on what she earns and what he's paying in terms of spousal maintenance, she's still short of her monthly need.
How is she short of her monthly need with the analysis?
The monthly need gross would be somewhere around, the $6,500
right,
is the monthly need.
That's
the monthly income is about somewhere between $72 to $75, depending on what she actually gets from the capped tier 2 spousal maintenance.
Right.
So
she gets more. than her monthly?
Well, no, because those are...
And that's the argument you're...
Yeah, no, 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 no. But her income is a gross number.
I understand.
So it's close, depending on whether he meets the Tier 2 standards or not. Okay? But the problem becomes, and this is where ultimately I think the rationale for secured life insurance comes into play, is that that's basically half her income, is the spousal maintenance. So if he were to pass away in the next 5 years, that would be a real problem for her.
Right. So I guess what I'm struggling with here is it sounds to me like you're not, and I, you know, excuse me if I'm missing something, it's not, doesn't sound to me like you're saying the district court ignored facts in the J&D. The district court cites facts and evidence from the J&D and then reaches a conclusion that is hard to understand, right? I mean, because if most of her income comes from spousal maintenance, then what does case law tell us we would do with requiring, a judge should do with as far as requiring security?
Yeah, fair enough. And I think what the district court did in this case is it makes basically, so they do these orders where it's the findings of fact and then the conclusions and then the order, which is a little different than when I started, which was findings and then the conclusions and order were the same thing. But he's got this middle section that is, I think the exact language is, under these circumstances, the court isn't going to order life insurance. And the two circumstances he lists right up above that are the issue of her income and his inability to meet the expense. Except there's really no findings as to his ability to meet the expense. And I don't know that, you know, the district court actually makes the determination that he doesn't need to get to that issue.
Is your argument that the district court was compelled to order security, or that we need to send it back so that the district court can make additional findings to support its decision?
That's what I would have you do. It's, you know,
and
I think
the purpose of doing that then? The district court's going to do the same thing.
Maybe. I don't know that. I mean, the problem that I see here is what I feel that the district court's order reads like is that she can earn more income, and so she's okay. That's what it feels like. It doesn't go, I mean, because the specific requirements of MATER, the things we look at, age, experience, work history, current income earnings, they all favor a life insurance security provision.
So, counsel, that's what I see that argument in your brief. Yeah. I don't see it in the district court's order that the district court decided that the repellent could make more money in case, if yeah. in the event the respondent passes away and she no longer gets spousal maintenance. I mean, I don't see that. Am I missing it?
I think you are. I think within the findings, uh-huh. I mean, one of the amendments he makes to the findings is this idea that in the future, she could earn more money.
Okay, good point.
Right, and
good
he changes
point.
That.
Yeah.
And that was because...
And that's actually in the memorandum, isn't it?
It's in both.
Oh, is it?
It's okay. In the order and
I'm
it's
sorry,
in the memorandum.
He made the amended. The district
yes.
court made the amendments.
Correct.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and while I understand Your Honor's point on remand versus reversal, I think the real issue becomes if what you're talking about here is, you know, I'm going to deny using my discretion in this way, because it seems to be what he's saying is that she's underemployed and that she could earn more money because of her education. And again, those are trial court discretion issues. I get that. But those weren't laid out really here. I know that the respondent's brief seems to suggest they are, but I don't see them in there. What I see is the court kind of hinting that she could earn more money. It seems to be saying that she could work full time, but there's no finding. And frankly, I don't think the court can change that income finding from its stipulated judgment decree. And that was our argument under Claybaugh. I think the issue becomes, if you're going to have parties stipulate to specific facts and findings, those facts and findings are what the court would then make its reserved issue order from, which is what I expected to happen here. Now, the court could very well have said, look, even if we find that she has the ability to work more, that she has all of these things, she could earn $150,000 a year, right? It didn't find those things, but even if it had said it, you still might, on a permanent maintenance award, secure it with spousal maintenance or with life insurance. And in this case, you could have also said the court may find that he can't afford it or can't become insured. Again, those weren't in front of the court because the court stated, I don't have information to do that, which is actually incorrect. That information was provided to the court. But again, I get that these are all discretionary issues, but the problem is that those facts have to be tied to the logic of what Mader v. Mader is. And I'm not certain that the court actually did that. So, unless there's anything else, thank you.
Thank you. Again, could you start with your name for the record?
Of course. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Timothy Lees, L-E-E-S. I am the attorney for Mr. Scott Olson, who is the respondent in this matter. I think part of the issue here is these parties settled their spousal maintenance case by stipulation, which a lot of parties do. We do this to get the case done. And when we do that, as in this case, contrary to if you tried the case to a court, the trial judge is going to make very specific findings on all of the factors under 518.552. This decree does not contain all those findings and all that analysis under the statute. So really, we have pretty bare-bones findings here. And what the parties decided to do was, we disagree on this separate issue, related but separate, on whether this should be secured by spousal maintenance. And in doing so, they agreed, we are both going to submit evidence to the court, we're going to try it by submission, we'll each put in the evidence we think is important on this issue, the life insurance issue, and the court was required to take that information and make findings of fact. And I disagree that that the trial judge changed the facts or changed any part of the substantive agreement behind that the parties had agreed to. Now, we've got to remember not to assign too much importance to the term permanent spousal maintenance, only as it differs from temporary. Temporary is for a determined term. Permanent maintenance, and a lot of clients are disappointed to learn, recipients, that permanent doesn't mean forever. It means until either the court changes the order or someone dies, the obligee or the obligor.
Please. So when it comes to these Mader factors, as the appellant's counsel is referring to them, those are the considerations case law has indicated a district court should weigh in deciding whether to require insurance or other security to secure permanent spousal maintenance. What's the rule of law, you know, for how those factors are applied? Because clearly the district court applied the factors here, but to what end? How do we, the factors themselves don't tell us to tip this way, tip that way, or at least not the way that it's expressed in case law.
I think we start with the first basic notion that ordering security is an exception to basic spousal maintenance law. As a matter of law, when an obligor dies, the spousal maintenance ends. Spousal maintenance by definition is...
So would you go back, though, to how the factors get weighed? I'm familiar with the case law as far as the exception and the long history. You know, and certainly I'm not going to take issue with what you briefed on that regard. So, but would you go back to those factors? How do those three, four factors outlined in Mader, how do they tip? What does the district court determine when they tip toward requiring security for spousal maintenance? So you look at those factors.
Okay, what's kind of what did this court do, or what is the guidance the court was supposed to be looking at? on those facts.
Well, you practice in this area, so I'm assuming that you're very familiar with the case law. So what's the rule of law that the district court is to follow in analyzing those factors? So, for instance, your opponent is arguing that where spousal maintenance is less, the amount of spousal maintenance when it's awarded on a permanent basis, the amount of spousal maintenance is less than the reasonable needs of the maintenance recipient, then security should be required. At least that's the argument I heard made.
I've seen no such law on that. And
okay,
in fact,
there's no case law saying that. So what does it say? So help me out. Yeah.
Well, again, there is not a bright line or black letter rule.
No, there are three factors.
So we have several cases that I've cited trying to show the court the various ways these are analyzed. I know I'm not answering the court's question, and I'm trying to here. Can you just give me 1 second, please? I think, well, clearly the order does not, in the court's findings, does not specify. I'm looking at this first finding as to their age, and I'm determining that 48 is an age that is young enough not to require security for the maintenance. He didn't do that. But again,
I'm sorry, you're losing me a little bit here. So I recognize appellant's age, at least as of the time this was decided, was 48. So you're saying that the district court implicitly found that appellant is young enough to not require security?
The court found that on the totality of these circumstances, yep, as balanced against examples in the case law, this was not a compelling case to be an exception to the general rule that spousal maintenance ends upon the obligor's death.
Right. I agree with that. What I'm trying to understand is what's the link between the factors and then going in that direction. So not security is not required because it seems to me
has been no compelling facts to show us why this case is different than a standard spousal maintenance case.
And I'm sorry if I'm just...
I'm not understanding the question. Okay. I apologize.
So the appellant is arguing, I'm just hoping you'll get to responding directly to the argument I heard anyway, is that here the district court decided to not require security because it determined as of, you know, by the end of these proceedings, so after the motion to amend, right, that appellant's income could change in the future. That was the analysis that led the district court to decline to require security.
I think it was one of the factors. Okay. And I think especially on one of the other factors, the court said, look, I'm not basing it just on this. I don't know if it was the insurance.
I'm talking about, it's the addendum 49, so it's, I think it's the last page of the memorandum denying the motion to amend. The district court says...
Yeah, I don't read it as the court relied on any one factor. Again, I think it is a totality of the circumstances analysis, and again, there was nothing that persuaded this court that maintenance shouldn't, I guess, end when it's supposed to end and not go to the exceptional case where we're going to start securing it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a more specific question about the record. So the district court, in denying the request to secure this award with maintenance, secure the maintenance with insurance, comments, let's see if I can find the exact reference, at the wife's...
Well, you're looking at that, could I make one comment?
Oh, go right ahead, yeah.
You know, one thing I think we should note is that with the party's submissions, the respondent did put in a lot of information on these issues. If you look to the appellant's affidavit, she didn't provide any affidavit testimony as to why the life insurance was needed. Her entire submission was her grievance that he had let the policy that was awarded to him lapse in support of her award for attorney's fees. She does not come forward and address the mater, the four mater factors.
Our case law doesn't require her to do that, though, does it?
If she's the party requesting the relief, that being the life insurance, most certainly it is her burden to come forward with facts to prove that.
And where what case stands for that proposition? That she has to put in an affidavit, which was your original argument.
What cases a party has to put in evidence to support their case?
Well, the affidavit, that's what you're arguing.
That was their submission.
Okay.
Did I answer that question, or am I confused on that?
No, I think
tough day for me on confusion. Mm-hmm. Apologize. I am trying to get to the question. Now, I had interrupted you, Judge Braffold.
Well, I guess what I'm asking you to do is go to discuss the district court's reasoning. You say it's a totality of the circumstances, but the district court makes some very specific findings about the appellant's ability to earn.
Okay.
Right? And makes this reference in finding of fact, I think it's number 11, that with the ability to earn $3,000 a month, $2,800 in spousal maintenance plus tier two maintenance, respondent is very close to meeting her agreed upon monthly expenses. The court has no evidence that respondent is unable to work full time. So help me understand how in the totality of the circumstances that supports the district court's decision not to award not to require security for the spousal maintenance. Because okay. if I look at that as in a mathematical sense, it looks as, it's the argument again, hoping to have the two of you talk to each other. So I've got the appellant saying that sentence suggests over half of her income is coming from spousal maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. So assuming security is in part to ease the difficulties that would follow, right, if perhaps respondent were to die before the end of his working years, right, and before uh-huh. or before the end of spousal maintenance, let's put it that way, then does that sentence logically factor into the district court's conclusion, and if so, how?
It does in the sense that I think what the court's saying is, in getting to whether there's compelling circumstances, there's nothing on the record that shows anything is limiting her ability to work. Now, they may have agreed that full-time or whatever for purposes of spousal maintenance.
So that's right, Stroh, because the J&D actually does talk about her ability to earn. I mean, that is what was one of the stipulated facts that the parties reached, right? I mean, I recognize the district court still made the findings regardless of what the parties did, but the finding is under spousal maintenance. Let's see. The parties hereby stipulate and agree that respondent, so that's now appellant,
yep.
has monthly expenses. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a line. Is capable of earning $20 per hour and working 35 hours per week for a total gross income of $36,400 or $3,000 gross a month. I mean, it specifically says capable of earning. So that's...
Also say she's capable of earning... would it be a true statement that she's capable of working 10 hours a week? I don't think this is saying this person is only able to work 35 hours a week.
Okay.
I don't believe that. And again, this gets back to my, we had findings in a contested maintenance case, I'm sure that would have been more addressed and vetted, and I would have expected with then submitting the evidence for trial on this issue that, again, the appellant would have provided more information on that. Mm-hmm. You know, again, the parties came to the court with all their income, my client did, with all the income, and it really explained his expenses and why, with additional expenses, he was not.
So maybe I'm missing something, counsel. Yeah. I thought in this portion of the J&D, uh-huh. right, again, a stipulation prepared by the lawyers in this case, signed off by the parties, submitted to the district court adopted it.
Yeah.
This portion, isn't it determining the now appellant's ability to meet her own needs? And it's saying her ability is roughly $3,000 a month.
But, Your Honor, any
no,
maintenance...
No, I'm wrong about that. That's not what this part of the JND is doing.
For purposes of settling their maintenance, sure.
Okay. And you don't think that that would also be a factor that the district court should look at in deciding whether to secure the maintenance?
Of course, but again...
Well, you say of course, but I don't see that in your briefing.
I'm sorry. Every single maintenance award, the recipient's expenses are going to be more than just what their income is alone. So if the idea is... Well,
I wasn't even talking about her expenses. I'm just talking about her ability to earn, counsel. And that to me is the tension with the district court's decision not to require security. I'm missing the logic. I'm not saying there couldn't be logic. I'm saying I don't see it in the district court's reasoning.
Nobody came forward with evidence saying that, explaining that. Or
explaining what?
Why the party settled on saying, okay, she has the ability to earn 35. I know the practical reasons when we're negotiating cases, but there's nothing about that that suggests there is some condition or ailment that is going to preclude her from working down the road.
Well, again, counsel, as I discussed with, I apologize. Can I finish one more question? All right. as I asked appellant's counsel, it seems to me that both sides are making some assumptions about what is full-time, right, as opposed to 35 hours in a week, which, at least in my experience, many employers do define full-time as 35 hours a week. We have that comment, we have that thread in this record, but we don't have a finding by the district court as to what full, and now you're assuming that full-time is 40 hours a week. You know, how do we review this case in light of some of these unstated assumptions?
Because
that's my
last
question.
Because I don't think the case hinges on that. I think you look at her age. She's younger than these cases where they give the security. She's got 17 more years left in the workforce. She's got no physical or mental disabilities. She has higher education. She has professional training. She's run a divorce law mediation business. And these are the factors that the court looked at and decided this isn't an exceptional case where she should, this should be secured by maintenance. I get frustrated with the term security. I think we've gone off the rails calling it security because it's not securing anything. It may be maintenance beyond death, but it isn't security because maintenance ends when a party dies, so there's nothing to secure.
Well, counsel, the statute refers to it that way, right? I mean, the statute trusts that to the district court. It's not something that...
Again, and this gets into something. That statute is generally not used for this purpose. That statute getting security is for people that aren't paying their maintenance, and we need to go secure, we need to go attach their assets, their retirement, and put that into a trust or and that's the security to make sure that maintenance keeps getting paid while they are alive. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, I'm way over my time and I apologize for that.
No need. We appreciate your willingness to answer the questions that the court has. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So first, you asked about the case that talks about insurability and cost. The court references it at Lee v. Lee. Lee v. Lee is an unpublished appellate case. It's not the Supreme Court case. It is the same case, but it is the unpublished version of that. And they are referencing Fredrickson.
Thanks, counsel.
Yes,
that is
Fredrickson
in the
versus Fredrickson.
Yep, thank you.
Yep. So a couple things. As to the evidence my client provided, she filed two things to the court. She provided an affidavit, and I think the court needs to understand the context of this, is that she provided an affidavit that showed he had insurance at the time this divorce was going on. I don't think we would be here if he had that insurance at the time of the dissolution.
That doesn't make sense, counsel, because when the parties presented the stipulation to the district court, this was a reserved issue, whether to require security.
Because we found out a week before the trial that he had let his insurance either lapse or stop paying it. And then the court, in its order, specifically
it made a mistake on that issue. If you look at the findings in its original order, I asked it to correct it. It basically said that it had lapsed after the entry of the judgment decree. That's the way I read it. We pointed that out to the court. It did lapse. The court, in its amended order, points out.
If you didn't raise this issue, I mean, this is a partial stipulation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the parties reserved some issues. This was one of them. If you hadn't raised the issue and had just trusted the respondent, is that what you're telling me?
Well, what
that he would continue to maintain life insurance?
Yes. What I am telling you is that in the course of almost every dissolution I've ever done over the course of 25 years, if insurance is already in place, you secure it because it's easy enough to do. It's already there. It's already getting paid. The problem is when there isn't insurance. One of the things that courts typically look at if you try the issue is, did you have insurance during the marriage, which shows a pattern of behavior.
So you're assuming that in this case the husband would have just agreed to continue?
There would have been no reason not to.
Okay.
He was already paying it. It was $50 a month.
You don't have anything in the record that suggests that, do you?
Well, other than in our argument when we did the original reservation. My client also did a memorandum that went to the court that talked about the factors. It's not that we just went into court and said that the court has to do this. We went into court and argued about the factors in the memorandum and pointed out these issues.
So now, I interrupted you, and you have so little time. You were going to explain what other evidence you offered in support of your motion.
And that was part of it. It was a memorandum. There were attached exhibits that showed that he had this policy. This was part of the problem. These two issues interconnect with the issue of attorney fees. Because what ended up happening is we had to have this battle on a permanent maintenance award, because it would be malpractice of me not to have that battle, unless there was some sort of issue involved in that. So we had the battle, but we had to have it because that insurance had been canceled. In terms of the age, I think the age is a red herring issue. It doesn't matter if she's 48, 42. It's the long-term extent of the marriage. And she is actually covering this gap between her current age and presumably retirement. When at that point, I assume the obligor comes in and says, hey, I'm now retired. I can't afford to pay this insurance anymore. And we do this all the time. You modify based on those changed circumstances. So nobody's asking for some sort of reward for the next 50 years. What we're asking for is a gap, in essence, if he dies between now and age 67 or 65 or his date of retirement, that he would come to the court. That, I think, is a reasonable solution based on a long-term marriage where, as the court asked, over half of what she's pulling from this long-term marriage is paying for her monthly expenses in the form of spousal maintenance. So to the suggestion that, you know, there is a, you know, why are we securing maintenance? Yes, you have a six-year marriage and you pay 2 years of maintenance, you probably don't need to secure that. You even go a little longer. You have a 10 or 12-year marriage and you have 4 or 5 years of maintenance. We make these calculations all the time and you don't secure those. And there's a reason for that. Maybe you didn't even have insurance at the time. But on long-term marriages, we have that discussion all the time. Any other questions?
I don't see anything.
Thank you, Your Honor,
for your arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have our decision within 90 days.